The Skiffy and Fanny Show is listener-supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty, sign up for a one-month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skiffyandfanty and enjoy the interview.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But Tikrell forgot one thing, yes. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, episode 136.
Military Industrial Politics and Red Nanotech with Linda Nagata.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
And our special guest is, Paul's taglines just ruin it because he always says who it is, so it's never a surprise for anybody. Then again, I label the episodes with the author's name, so I guess we both ruin it. But our special guest is Linda Nagata, so welcome to the show, Linda.
Hi, thank you. It's great to be here.
So you've got a new book that just came out called The Red.
The Red First Light.
First Light. Which has this really cool cover that almost looks like he's in a volcano world. Although we know from the story he's not in a volcano world. It's just the lighting. It's actually kind of cool looking. Just to kind of start with the question we ask all the new folks who are on, you've been writing for a very long time now in terms of just the breadth of your published material. So what kind of got you into writing? And why did you go to science fiction as opposed to, being a mystery writer or whatever?
Well, what got me into writing was in college, I studied biology. And by my last semester, we started doing field work. Oh. And I discovered that while I really liked the theory, I wasn't all that into the field work. So I was just going to be a writer instead. I figured I could do it better than some of these terrible books I was reading. And about after maybe 10 years of practice, I got to that point. So that's my story of how I got into writing.
See, that's really interesting because I'm an English major now because I hate chemistry. And the reason I hate chemistry is because I don't want to be stuck in a lab. But if I were able to be one of those people that observes monkeys all day long in the wild, I would do that job in a heartbeat.
See, I thought I would like that too, but then we had this project where we needed to pick seaweed off the concrete wall of a structure right at the edge of the ocean, and then we needed to come back several weeks later, actually once a week, and collect more seaweed to do a succession experiment. And suddenly I decided this wasn't quite as fascinating as I'd originally thought.
I suppose when you're collecting seaweed from a wall, after a while, it's not as exciting. Because, I'm sure from a molecular perspective, seaweed's interesting. But if you're expecting, to be like Jane Goodall, there's really not...
Who was my childhood hero, by the way. She was my inspiration, yes.
Yeah, but seaweed doesn't have a complex... culture per se,
or salt marsh grasses, which is what I had to collect and study when in my abortive attempt to be a scientist. So I can perfectly understand Linda's defascination with doing scientific field work.
It's so weird because I wanted to be a marine biologist for a while until I discovered that I was terrified of the ocean. And if I had tried to do that and they had me collecting sea grass and seaweed, I imagine I would get really bored. I'd be like, I want to look at whales.
But at that point, I thought that writing about natural history would have been a lot more interesting than actually doing the field work. But
That's an interesting way.
But I went to fiction writing instead because that's even more fun.
It's an interesting way of because you know so many science fiction writers start, you know, we think of all the great science fiction writers, half of them were scientists. Like Asimov was a nuclear physics guy. He was nuclear, right?
Asimov, no, he was chemistry.
Chemistry, sorry. He talked about nukes all the time and atomic
about
energy.
Everything. Yeah.
Yeah. But like, you know, there's Asimov, there's Greg Bear, there's David Brin, who's a scientist, there's all of these scientists just flooded everywhere who then went to write fiction. But you tried to be a scientist and you said it, you would much rather just do the fiction instead of doing the science, which is just a different route. It's a different route than, you know, what is typically associated with genre.
Mm-hmm.
So, and so that was sort of the basis for why you, I mean, were you always a science fiction reader or?
Yes. As far as I can remember, my dad used to read it all the time. So there were always books around and I picked up the habit from him, but I really consider myself interested in what I think of as adventure fiction. Lots of action, things happening. I remember even as 9 or 10 years old, I'd go to the library and I'd skip all the books that were about broken families or, you know, just sad circumstances, and I'd go directly for all the adventure books. Haven't changed. Haven't grown up.
Did you read Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew?
I did not, no.
Oh, okay. I read Hardy Boys. Didn't read Nancy Drew, but I think that was because I was a sexist when I was 9.
Mm-hmm. Most of us are.
Yeah. You're supposed to read Hardy Boys. You can't be a man if you read Nancy Drew. Screw that. I will read Nancy Drew now. So, but yeah. But there are a lot of really interesting sort of classic old school adventure stories. A lot of the precursors to steampunk are these old, what I think are typically written for boys, unfortunately, because they're old. But like these late 1800s boys adventures in which like the main character is this super smart genius guy and he goes on a great adventure and he's like 9 and somehow he builds dirigibles, you know, in those kind of silly science fiction ways, you know, where you see the films like MacGyver, only 9, a 9-year-old MacGyver from the late 1800s.
That sounds fantastic.
I can't remember the name of the types of stories. There's a name for them. And I'll see if I can remember them, and send you a link and maybe you could look them up and you could laugh at how silly the old days were, but yet at the same time, so much fun. So anyway, so why don't we dive into the book, The Red First Light, since it has it officially dropped yet?
Officially Tuesday. It's available. It's been out like on my website for a couple days, but it's available officially Tuesday.
Okay, cool. So it opens in a very familiar, I want to say a very familiar kind of setting, because in a lot of respects, this book is interested in contemporary concerns, but obviously translated a little bit into the future. And one of the things I was curious about was, while, you know, science fiction has always had, you know, mechanized exoskeleton type stuff, like people inside machines or machine-like stuff to enhance their abilities, what for you was the kind of impetus behind using that in this sort of near future military?
I saw, I saw videos of one under development and I thought, that's really cool. I'm going to use that.
It's probably the same one that's been going around of like the people lifting weights and stuff with a little like bizarre pack thing.
Actually, no, it's a different one from that. That one's a much heftier looking exoskeleton. There's another one. I can't remember if it was. It was not Raytheon. It was another company. It had where they have somebody wandering around on the rocks wearing the suit wearing the exoskeleton. Anyway, that was pretty much what it was based on. I just tend to get ideas and shove them into the story, to be perfectly honest.
So do you suspect that a future in terms of technologically something like what we see in The Red is pretty much around the corner for us?
If they can figure out how to power it for an extended period of time, I would imagine, yeah.
Well, give it a week, the Chinese will figure it out. Because I find it really interesting, that kind of exoskeleton stuff, because, you know, 10 years ago, I would have thought, oh, that's just science fiction. But then I read your book and I think in 10 years, we might actually be looking at this very situation in which our military are, to a large degree, partially mechanized. And that's cool and terrifying at the same time. Because of what that means for warfare. I mean, we're already seeing the changes in warfare in terms of the use of military drones, which we also see in this particular book. You have essentially a kind of nano wetware kind of interface in which the character, your main character, can actually look through the eyes of what is essentially a drone, which that too, I mean, did they just release something on IO9 about we might actually have telekinetic abilities using implants, wireless implants, and I think they're doing it on dogs because they're crazy. But it's just weird how when you read something like this, and we're getting to that point from a societal perspective where it's starting not to sound like science fiction anymore, even though it technically is.
And yeah, it's been interesting working on the book. I mean, the connection with the drone in the book is normal. I mean, it's just an electronic display on the visor, but they do have they are developing ideas for how to basically read your mind with these, I think it's magnetic resonance. And as I write this book, different parts of it seem to keep popping up in the news. I mean, just this morning, somebody posted, a link to a young college student who's developed a gel to put in wounds and immediately stop bleeding. And I'm like, oh, that was in my book.
It's actually kind of creepy.
How has that process been for you, Linda? Some of your early books, the Nanotech Secession novels, were set mostly in the intermediate future. Setting aside some of your other au revoir for the moment, you jumped to the tech heaven, which is a little more closer, and now you've jumped even closer to modern day. How has that been as a writer, writing closer and closer to the present?
Absolutely terrifying. You just know you're going to get it all wrong. And there's a worry the book will be completely out of date in a very short time. But I just tend to try to look at it as an alternate world, so I don't have to worry about how far off I really am.
Well, and unfortunately, with the near future, I mean, it's almost guaranteed. You're something you do is not going to happen the way you write it.
Because
just the way things change. I mean, who knows? You set this particular book in parts of Africa. Who knows? Maybe the next theater of conflict is going to be, I don't know, Australia, right? Probably not, but it might be. Who knows, right? And then your whole setting's screwed. You've got the whole history wrong. But
yeah. On the other hand, the conflict in Mali was kind of well timed.
So you'll either end up being this really creepy predictive genius, or you'll have written a really cool book that technically is more alternate history.
Right.
Yeah, it kind of reminds.
It'll work either way, right?
But it's still, I think, as a thought experiment. That's one of the things that science fiction is so fun at doing. That it allows us to kind of play is the right word. Like playing in not quite a fantasy universe, but like, you know, the what if, the big possibilities. Like, what will the world look like in 10, 15, 20, 30 years? We don't really know. It probably won't look like anything we can imagine, but the imagining, it still gives us a way of looking at how the world currently functions in a way. Mm-hmm. And that was actually something I was very curious about. And then, Paul, maybe you'll want to take us back to a different question, but since we're on it, this is set in Africa, which, based on what's happening right now in terms of most of the conflict with the United States, and obviously Mali's with the exception here, but Africa, I think, for a lot of people, would not be the place where we would expect all the conflict to be occurring in terms of American interest. But yet, a lot of the sort of Arab Spring stuff occurred in Northern Africa, among other areas as well. And I'm very curious. What was it that compelled you to kind of write about this particular part of the world? And were you at all concerned? Well, I guess the question is, what made you kind of go to that setting? But also, did you come at that from a personal experience? Did you research it from the outside? What was kind of the research process to write about this part of the world?
I had two or three places in mind where I could have started the book, and I just picked this one. I wish I had a big, long political reasoning behind that, but it'd been a place where I hadn't said anything before. It was sufficiently far away from the United States that it was a little different. And it just seemed like a fairly vulnerable area of the world, because that's kind of how the book starts off, right? Is that wars are made to keep the defense contractors in business. That's the outlook of the protagonist, who says so on the very first page of the book.
Yep.
And I have never been there. No, I've never done much traveling at all. So it was all outside research. It's just amazing to me. Throughout this whole process of this book, it's been amazing how much information you can find on the internet. Peace Corps workers posting their experiences, people who just travel putting their pictures up on Flickr. It's incredible. It's completely different from trying to write a book back in the 90s.
Yeah, when almost none of this information was at your fingertips.
Mm-hmm.
Sending a picture on the net would have taken you 3 hours.
Yeah. I mean, in the acknowledgments, I have that. It's just the internet is absolutely amazing.
So a lot of your research was kind of done by essentially perusing experiences from other people who had, like you said, like Peace Corps members would have spent considerable time immersed in the culture doing various work. I mean, we've had Jason Sanford, who's on the show, who was part of the Peace Corps, and he certainly gets much of his writing influence from doing that. And you found that through Flickr and these other kinds of sites, presumably blogs about the same thing.
Yes.
How did you kind of go about finding that stuff? Were you just like randomly Googling?
Yes. Absolutely.
I love Google. You find such amazing things. Like, just imagine the keywords that you use to search.
Well, I mean, now that I have my smartphone and I can talk to it, and my husband and I will be driving around and we'll have some random question, I just ask my phone and I get the answer. And this is just amazing to me.
And soon you won't even have to ask the phone. It'll just go into your head.
I don't know why that isn't happening already.
We're not quite there yet.
I expect it, though. Sometimes I have two computers running and I'll do a copy on one, and I don't know why I can't just paste onto the other, you know?
It would be kind of cool. Paul, you had a question earlier. Did you want to jump back on that?
Actually, I'm going to go to a slightly different question, since okay. We've been talking about the internet so much, and the internet has a big part of this book, without trying to give too many spoilers for those who haven't read as far or haven't picked up the first page. So what were your inspirations in developing the internet and its evolution as you did, Linda?
Trying to decide how much I can talk about without spoilers.
Well, if it helps, we can put a spoiler alert, a provisionary spoiler alert, in case you say something.
Okay, let's do a provisionary spoiler alert.
Okay.
The background part of the book is something that just popped into a story that I wrote for Lightspeed Magazine that came out last May, and it was called Night Sight on Callisto.
Right. And
one of the background elements was something that I grabbed and used in this book, so they're actually they're in the same story world. Let's put it that way.
That's what I was going to ask, whether it was this connected. I didn't feel like it was connected to the nanotech world. It just didn't match up right, especially as things develop. I was wondering if this was hanging off of something else, and I think I read Nightside on Callisto and just didn't quite connect that to it. But okay, that makes perfect sense now.
Yeah, and it's actually a little more complicated than that, because I wrote this story, which is just out now in the current issue of Asimov's, which is called Through Your Eyes. And that was the story that basically inspired the novel.
Hmm.
And if you look at Through Your Eyes and Nightside on Callisto, they look like they have absolutely nothing to do with each other. But through some alchemy, I decided that they did belong together. One's just at one end of a timeline, one is at the other. And then the novel is much more towards the beginning of the timeline. So the character in Through Your Eyes is also the main character in The Red First Light.
Now that's interesting. So there's actually, for those that want to explore further, there's other material, there's various stories that are attached to this world. Do you expect to write more in this particular world?
Oh, yes. There will definitely be at least one more novel, and there'll probably be two more.
So people are going to have a lot to look forward to, which is good. That's actually really good. So kind of jumping back, because unless, Paul, did you have another question on this particular topic?
On this particular topic, no, but I have plenty of other questions.
Okay, well, why don't you ask another? I don't want to monopolize Linda's time. I want you to get in.
More of a general question. Was your father in the military?
World War II.
Oh, okay, because I know he moved around, and you at one point he had moved to Guam and you hadn't, and I was just wondering if he was, and that if that had informed the military stuff in the novel. I hadn't heard that in any end of the interview I've read of yours before. I was just wondering if I had missed something.
No, he was a pilot in World War II. He was actually a bomber pilot in the Philippines, 20 years old. But after the war, he got out of the military. I guess he was reserved for a while. But no, he never had anything else to do with military directly. He worked civil service for the Navy, which was why we moved around, and actually why we wound up in Hawaii.
Okay.
Yeah, we lived in San Diego when I was very young, and the office where he worked closed. And they told him he could go to Guam or he could go to Bakersfield. And being who he was, he says, "I'll take Guam."
I've been to Bakersfield. I would make the same choice.
Oh my gosh.
And apparently, I really don't know what happened. I was 9 years old. My mom said, "I'm not going to Guam." So after a few months, he got a transfer to Pearl Harbor. And that's how I wound up in Hawaii.
Now that's interesting. So clearly this had some influence on why you've chosen this kind of military theme.
That, and also my son was in the Navy for 2 years, and my daughter was an Army wife for 2 years. So
military is essentially in your family's blood, as it were.
Lately it is. Yeah, not for a long time, and then all of a sudden it was.
It's interesting how that happens. It just kind of jumps out of nowhere. And I'm curious, because I know some people who I think they're still currently living in Hawaii who are Army. In Hawaii now, what is your experience in terms of the military in Hawaii? And more like personal, living in Hawaii, you get a different kind of perspective on military, because Hawaii is understandably a much smaller space, so it's not as easy to disappear, I guess, from the military presence. What's kind of your experience there in terms of that?
Well, it's kind of mixed in that I live on Maui, where there is no military presence, basically. There's National Guard, and that's about it. On Oahu is where the big concentration is, and it's a huge part of the economy here. It's, I guess it's second to tourism for the economy of the state. And rarely do I hear people objecting to it. It's just always been here, and it very likely always will be. It works.
Presumably. I mean, there's certainly resistance from certain native activist groups who are not particularly happy, I imagine. But that may be
there
more.
There are, but it's, I mean, from what I see, it's not a huge deal.
Okay. So it seems particular, not as pronounced as perhaps maybe it was in the distant past. I'm curious about that because of Hawaii's kind of lineage in terms of the United States, of how it becomes a state, et cetera, which is one of the interesting things that I've found is when you talk to, I teach college, and when you talk to students and you ask them, like, how did Hawaii become a state, they don't really know. It was just kind of there, and it became a state, and it's like, not quite. Like, it wasn't like we just popped in or like, well, it's a state. Like, it's a little bit more complicated.
It's a little more complicated, yes. Yeah.
But it is very interesting because, of course, the military presence has, I think, in a lot of ways, like you were suggesting, I mean, it has really shaped the state in a very pronounced way. And I think in particular, because of the events of World War II, completely just changed, I guess, the position of Hawaii in American politics or American sovereignty, whatever you want to say, just because that event was essentially pivotal for that particular war in that period. And it's since been, and I suspect you're right, it's probably always going to have a strong military presence just because of its position.
Right. One land area out in the middle of a big empty ocean. You know, and I'm not saying that nobody objects to the military presence here. I just think the vast majority of the people understand it and are okay with it.
Yeah. What's it like, just a completely random question that has nothing to do with anything, but what's it like to live on a island way out in the middle of essentially nowhere, surrounded by a huge body of water? Because I've lived on an island before, but I was always like within, if I were an Olympic swimmer, I might be able to make it to the coast if like my island got flooded. Mm-hmm. But I don't know what it's like to actually live on a place like Hawaii where there's no mainland nearby. You got to take a plane or a big boat.
Yeah, it's pluses and minuses. I mean, it's a beautiful place, obviously, and there's a whole lot of nice reasons to live here. And on the other hand, it's a 5-hour and several hundred dollar flight to go anywhere else, which makes it a little difficult to attend conventions and work on your writing career on a face-to-face basis. But and a lot of people dream of living here. They come here and suddenly realize this isn't what they thought it was, and they, within a year, they're gone. And then other people come here, realize this is what they were born for, and they never leave. So it really depends on the individual. I've lived here long enough that I'm entirely used to only being able to drive around in circles, basically. But I mean, the islands are big, they're diverse. A lot of different environments. There's a lot of undeveloped land here, basically because it's hard to get to. The terrain is so steep.
And the wildlife must be fascinating.
The wildlife is fascinating, but it's also very sad because most of the native life is on its last legs. I hate to say it.
Oh, but yeah. In particular with the, there's that particular species of frog that it's killing off all of the local frog species.
We don't have local frog species.
What were they killing off then?
Well, they're not really. They're an invasive species. I'm trying to think what their specific problem is, but they're just everywhere. If you go over to Hilo at night, the entire town chirps. I mean, it's actually kind of a nice sound, but I can see why it drives people crazy.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose if you live there, you would assume that you would just get used to it, but maybe people don't. Maybe people really get annoyed with chirping at night. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. We don't have that here on Maui, but basically the wildlife here is what could manage to reach an island in the middle of the ocean. So there's birds, there's a species of bat, there's some marine animals like a seal, turtles.
Sharks.
But there's no sharks. But there's no native, besides the bat and the seal, there's no native mammals. I don't think there's any native reptiles that are land animals. There's a lizard that's origins might be debated, but that's about it. So it's really a very, very unusual kind of environment here.
That's interesting. And also kind of sad because the human's ability to screw over the damn ecosystems and kill off all the local stuff, it's not fair.
And not even intentionally, just bringing stuff along by accident that just gets right. loose. Ever since the Polynesians discovered the islands, it's 1,000 years of ecological change.
Definitely. There used to be species of large flightless geese, for example, here, which disappeared very rapidly once people made it to the islands.
Yeah, that sounds like food. Yeah.
Yes. But, yeah, and unfortunately, I mean, it's slightly more reasonable to possibly control invasive species. But, I mean, in the old days when they're, you know, riding around in big wood boats, all sorts of weird crap just hiding around in the boat. I mean, unless you have a herd of cats living on your boat, you're not going to catch all the little critters that are going to come floating in.
But it's worse now. I mean, with all the container shipping and airline flights, there was a big group here on Maui who wanted to keep our runway short so that international flights couldn't land because they were worried that, say, the brown tree snake from Guam would somehow manage to sneak aboard the plane and get here.
Oh, yeah. I actually heard about that because some of my students way back when actually wrote a proposal about how to control that particular snake's invasion, because they've found a couple in various parts of the world that are not native. They've come in somehow through shipping crates or on planes or whatever. They just snuck in and they've just been fortunate to have caught them to prevent them from making a like little colonies like they have in Florida with various species. Mm-hmm. But they're a pain in the butt. Those little bastard snakes.
Yeah, wow, go ahead.
I thought the zebra mussel problem up here was bad. Brown tree snakes is another matter entirely.
Well, because they eat everything. They eat, I mean, well, I shouldn't say they eat everything, but they would essentially completely destroy the local bird populations. Because I think that particular snake eats the eggs. It may actually eat the birds, the smaller birds too, but I mean, it would devastate if there were colonies, and once you get colonies, it's almost impossible to get rid of them.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's just like in Florida, the only thing keeping Burmese pythons from becoming the dominant snake species here is that they come from a climate where it never gets freezing cold. Whereas once in a while we get a cold snap in Florida and that actually devastates the populations that are here. But we need to get cold saps regularly for that to happen. And unfortunately, we're not getting frequent enough cold saps that affect the Everglades well enough. So we're probably going to be stuck with Burmese pythons. And you could open up hunting season on Burmese pythons all you want, but you're not going to kill them all off. It's just not going to happen. Once they get colony, that's it. Unfortunately.
Yep.
And that's the same thing that can happen, you know, in a place like Hawaii, which is isolated except for the fact that humans have a way of unisolating or de-isolating. sorry, that was totally random tangent, but I do think it's very interesting because, you know, we don't really have people frequently from places surrounded by miles and miles of water. So. Mm-hmm. Thousands of miles of water. It's actually weird when you look at Hawaii on the map. This is, again, just completely unrelated to anything that has to do with your book, except for that you're the author. But when you look at Hawaii, like, people always think of Hawaii is kind of close, you know, because sometimes you'll see maps where it shows Hawaii, or like it shows Hawaii in that little triangle at the bottom just to show it up close. But then when you look at an actual map, like, Hawaii is way the hell out there.
Yes.
It's, like, nowhere near the coast. Like, you probably can't row a boat there. I don't think so.
Well, I've snatched from Kate Elliott my favorite description of it. She calls it the uttermost west.
That's a great description. I like Kate. We need to get her on the podcast sometime, Sean.
Yes, sir. I shall do thy bidding. Anyway, so I think Paul has a question that may be related to the book.
or actually, I'm going to jump into a different part of Linda's career. You started off in science fiction. You nominated for a couple awards, wrote the nanotech novels. You're in science fiction now, but there's also fantasy. And I was just curious what motivated you to write the Puzzle Land novels and also the Wild, which you're serializing on your website, mythicisland.com?
Mm-hmm. Mythicisland.com. The Wild was a book that I started writing in the early part of the century. And I just, at the time, I was kind of burned out on science fiction. I felt like I'd been getting farther and farther out there. And I just wanted to come back and do something that was non-tech. Mm-hmm. And so I worked on that for quite a while. It went through at least 3 different revisions. It never did manage to sell. So I eventually decided I'd just go ahead and start serializing it on my blog. I had flirted with the idea of writing it one more time, but I thought, no, I'm not going to do that. And then I actually didn't write much of anything for a while after that. And I was frankly frightened of writing, I guess is the way to put it. It's like I'd done these 6 books in traditional publishing. They'd been well reviewed and they had never sold very well. And I just had this feeling that whatever I did, I was scared to commit, I guess, to another book. And I sat down one day and I read a column by Dean Wesley Smith about not worrying about, how shall we put it, hitting the ball out of the park with your next novel. Just sit down and write a book and enjoy doing it. Write it fast, get it done, move on to the next one. And I've never written like that. I've always done an outline. I've always perfected each chapter before moving on to the next one. And this was an entirely different way of writing. So I thought, I'm just going to do something fairly simple, fairly quick, something that was fun. So I sat down and wrote this Puzzle Lands book, and I think I had it written and published within about 4.5 months. And it was a whole lot of fun to do. I really enjoyed it. And so I wrote a second one.
Happened to Watcher, yeah.
Same world. And neither of them have sold very well. It's like my science fiction readers can't believe I actually sat down and wrote fantasy, and my potential fantasy readers seem to think they don't want to read a fantasy by a science fiction writer. So I'm hoping someday they'll catch on, because I'd really like to do another one.
I admit I was surprised when I first heard, what? She's writing fantasy? What is this? And then I read it and I liked it and I reviewed it. So yeah, there is a mental thing to overcome, for especially for older readers, to be like, hey, she wrote fantasy. Yeah, she can. Deal with it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, nobody's actually come out and said straight up, what the hell are you doing? But I've had some kind of sideways comments like, oh, I heard you're writing fantasy now.
But that's really interesting, because a lot of science fiction authors these days seem to at least be dipping their toes in fantasy and to one degree or another, and some just jumping with both feet. So it's not quite that unusual anymore. Especially, seems to me, the market seems to be orienting, tilting in that direction. Wouldn't you agree, Sean?
Yeah, I mean, and I think that writers have actually probably crossed over more than we think, because they get away with it by using pseudonyms. So, like, Tim Pratt has, I swear, he's got like 4,000 pseudonyms now. He's written in like 3 different genres at some point. And other authors who have so many pseudonyms, they're crossing over. But I think there is certainly a more of a move towards authors crossing over to fantasy, although I can't think of a lot of really good examples at the moment. But that's fortunately or unfortunately for science fiction, that's the thing right now. People are fantasy is like the hit a genre it crowd thingy, whatever you want to call it. In part, I think, because of what's been going on in television the last, I'd say, 13 years, I guess, since we've had how many books now turned into fantasy books turned into movies or miniseries or whatever.
No, I agree. Fantasy just seems huge. I mean, you just have to look at the Nebula ballot for this year.
Yeah, yeah. Or even the Hugo ballot was pretty heavy fantasy, too.
Yeah, but this last one, 5 out of 6 fantasy novels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Poor Kim Stanley Robinson seems almost out of place with 2312 on that list with The Dreaming Moon and whatnot.
Yeah, and I suspect that Robinson's probably not going to take it. I think it's going to be one of the fantasy writers. And not to say there's anything bad about Robinson. I just think that the Nebula is going to go to a fantasy novel this year.
The odds look like it.
Yeah, they certainly do. It's very strange, actually, how things have shifted so much. And, you know, I mean, science fiction's not dead. I don't want to make, because I would hope not, Linda. You just wrote a science fiction book. Yeah. That would be bad. But there's certainly a shift. And I say a shift in the sense that original non-series, non-media tie-in stuff. Because, like, let's face it, the Star Wars novels always sell really well, and those are ostensibly science fiction. And they're probably always going to sell well, no matter, like, all other science fiction could go away, and Star Wars would still sell best-selling books, just the way it is. But there is a weird shift away from science fiction in terms of the literature, but not in terms of the film. Science fiction film is destroying the market. It really is. It's so strange when the shift. So, like, science fiction as a genre is not dead. It's just there does seem to be a lull in certain aspects of the publishing sphere, and I don't know what the cause of that is.
I don't know, but, I mean, you know, Alistair Reynolds seems to be doing great. So.
That's right. He got that, was a 10-book deal for, like, £1 million or something.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's just, who knows? It may just be a phase. It could just be that, you know, because it's just the it thing, people are, like, into their big sprawling fantasy series and all that stuff, and then in 10 years it'll shift and we'll have werewolves in space. Who knows? I don't know, that'd be kind of cool, werewolves in space.
Yeah, how do they change?
I was going to say, there's no moon.
It's nanotech. They change via nanotechnology, which is, it's an augmented, they're soldiers, or augmented soldiers, which, when they go into combat mode, yeah.
That would be the Hulk in space then, right?
But they go into, like, werewolf form because teeth are awesome.
Okay.
So that would be, like, Paul McCauley's Fairyland in space.
Yes.
You haven't read Paul McCauley's Fairyland, have you?
No, I have not.
What you're talking about.
No idea.
See, I'm the voice of experience on this podcast, Linda.
Hey, I read quite a lot of stuff, thank you. But
I'm only giving you some crap.
No, but you know, who knows what the next big thing, like, right now, for a while it was urban fantasy, and that's still big. Mm-hmm. But then it became sort of the, like, gritty epic fantasy stuff, because you had Joe Abercrombie and various other authors writing these kind of gritty things, and then, of course, you had the Game of Thrones, which has always been popular, but then, of course, the TV series hit, and that completely changed everything. And you know what? In another decade, we could see another huge shift, because let's face it, the market's going to get tired of, you know, what is hot right now. Not tired to the extent that it'll go away, but certainly, like, the market's going to want the new thing, whatever that new thing is. Yeah.
I think we need to make that shift to near future thrillers right about now.
Well, we kind of have those, though. I mean, aren't they? That's a good point. That actually goes to your book, because your book's essentially a near future thriller.
Yeah.
But what's really interesting is when you look at the bestseller lists, or, well, at least when you have in say, the past 10 years, a lot of near future science fiction thrillers have been on the bestsellers list and been doing really well. They're just not marketed as science fiction. They're always marketed as just a thriller, an action thriller, a tech thriller. But they have all of these elements that are, I mean, they're obviously science fiction. They just aren't. Like, you know, that we're not flying in spaceships to Jupiter and stuff, but
right. And yeah. That's actually kind of been my thought on this book. It depends who I'm talking to, whether I just call it a near future thriller or call it a science fiction near future thriller.
And it changes everything from the way you market the book, because if you were to call it, just a thriller in the marketing sense of the term, you probably wouldn't have a cover like you have. You'd have to change the, I would imagine, for that particular audience, the cover would have to look different. If we're talking in marketing terms, just because
okay. Straight thriller, yeah.
Yeah, because just the way that they're marketed, they're not marketed with what is, for this particular book, is a very clear science fiction-looking concept for the cover.
Mm-hmm.
But when you market it as science fiction, I mean, assuming, you know, we're talking like a marketing department, but...
Yeah, you call me.
Yeah, but it changes so much, but at the same time, they're essentially the same damn thing. They're just changing the name.
Mm-hmm.
And, packaging, yeah.
Yeah, the packaging. I mean, you even look at, like, the books are really old now, but even the films, like the Bourne Identity films, I consider those to be really, really near future science fiction. Like within the next 5 years kind of stuff. Because there are little bits and pieces of that are, like, we probably have the capability to do everything that happens in those movies, but we're not, as far as I know, doing them yet. And
you wouldn't know, would you?
Well, I guess we wouldn't know unless there was, you know, Bourne shows up and he starts blowing up and beating up cops and stuff, maybe. But that kind of stuff is, it's happening, and it's so weird that, adopted into the science fiction repertoire. It's just been allowed to kind of sit over there in its own universe. It's like, no, that's our stuff too.
Mm-hmm. Like,
why aren't they a part of us? And then, of course, you write this book, and we're back to science fiction kicking ass again. So with your exoskeletons and all these kinds of things, which appear all science fiction-y, and then you think about it, yeah, not 10 years out, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe that's even – I'm probably being, like, way too generous. It's probably, like 3 years from now, we're going to have, like, exoskeleton dudes in military. So.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of the fun thing of the book is that, I mean, so much of the background is like life now with these other elements thrown in. So it was this kind of mix of things that we have and things that we almost have.
And then, of course, the politics, which is, I'd said earlier, is obviously very contemporary. When you just think about the way in which the last two major wars have been fought from the U.S. perspective, private contractors have been, private military contractors have been an integral part of those missions. And that's right from the very start of the book. That's a central concern or question, the relationship between a nation, its military, and its defense contractors, which I find very interesting because that's certainly not something I expected to see in a science fiction novel, and maybe I'm just not reading the right kinds of novels, but you certainly hit it on the head right from the start. This is a question that's being asked right from the beginning.
Yeah. It is like almost like the tail wagging the dog with the defense contractors. We want another war. This war is good for us. Let's go to the Sahel. That would be great. I'm thinking, oh my God, this is cynical. But I can't really argue with it because, yeah, I could see people thinking this way. It was really well done, Linda.
Thank you.
Also creepy. Well, it really is because then you think about it as though, like, oh, that'll never happen. But then you just look at the way the state of politics, you know, is. It's not, I mean, it may not be happening the way that the characters imagine it at the beginning of this novel, in which, like, defense contractors are intentionally waging war or nations are intentionally starting new wars just to keep the defense contractors going. But there's certainly a lot of argument to be had about that. I mean, even Eisenhower warned about what he saw as the military-industrial complex in his farewell address. He said almost explicitly this was his concern, that the driving force behind a nation would be its defense contractors, its people making better and better bombs, which in and of itself is not a problem unless that becomes so powerful as an economic incentive that it literally becomes an economic incentive to be at war, which is of course the presumed setting of the beginning of at the beginning of this book, where your main characters think about that very question, you know.
Yeah, and I mean it is a huge part of the economy, and it's, you know, defense contractors make a lot of money off of taxpayers to create weapons to keep us up with you know, at the level of other countries, but it seems like there's a lot more money to be made if you can actually keep the warlike attitude going, which is basically the character's opening philosophy at the beginning of the book. And I read a book last fall. It was called Republic Lost. I don't remember the author's name right now, but it was very interesting in the way that it talked about how influence runs in Congress, and it seemed to play right into the way that my book works, which was always nice to see. But
is that the book by Lawrence Lessig?
Yes, that's
okay.
It.
Yeah, Republic Lost: How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It.
Yeah,
that's the full title. That's from 12 Press, so, and has a lot of really big names that reviewed it. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, and the basic idea is that it, once you get elected, your biggest problem is getting reelected, and whoever can help you out with that tends to get more of your time, and that's pretty much the whole book. And it's kind of depressing at the end, because he offers possible means of solving the problem that he's explained, and none of them seem convincing to me. So
that's depressing. It's actually something I was, and this is actually related to the sort of military situation in your book, that something that had been talked about with the sequester, apparently, and I don't know how true this is, it's just what people are saying on Facebook, and there are lots of petitions going around about college tuition benefits for military service people are being cut as a result of the sequester. I don't know if that's true. I can't confirm it. It probably is.
I saw an actual article on that.
Okay, so it is happening.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, one of the interesting things is one of my friends from high school was posting, like, you know, I don't understand how this is even rational. Like, why would we do this for service members? And my thought was, well, because there aren't lobbyists for service members. There are lobbyists for politicians, but there's no large body of money that is defending the military, the service members. There are people defending, you know, the companies that, like Boeing, etc. They have their own lobbyists, which understandably, because they get, I mean, I'm not saying as a moral question, it's more like, well, they get more defense contracts, they get more money, that's good for the company, duh. But then these things happen to our military service, and it's like, well, where are their lobbyists? They don't have any. They don't have anyone that's sitting around. And in fact, there's this odd culture that's developed in which it's okay to, like, attack someone for their military service, even though there's nothing technically wrong with their military service. So, like, what's happening with the fellow that Secretary of Defense? Oh, God, what is his name?
Hagel.
Right. There have been people who have attacked him for his military service, and it's like, but he actually served.
Yeah, as opposed to, yeah.
Yeah, the verb is called swift boating.
Mm-hmm.
Right, yes, this new term called swift boating, where you can attack somebody for what is essentially exemplary service. I mean, even Kerry, like, sure, I'm sure there's some stuff he did while he was in the military that was wrong, or not good, or whatever, or maybe was slightly over-embellished, okay, but it's not like the military just hands out Purple Hearts for shits and giggles, right? Like, you have to get injured to get Purple Heart. He didn't, like, fall down and, like, cut himself on a rock and went, I got shot by bullets. No, like, he got injured. Or like, someone like John McCain, who I disagree with him politically on many things, but, like, if anyone who attacks him for his military records, like, the guy was a POW.
For 5 years.
For, like, you know, he needs a little bit of respect for that, you know? But it's that culture now, and it's very, very strange to live in a culture where you can attack someone for their military record, when for so long it was like a badge of honor. If you had someone running for president who served in the military, it was like that gave them brownie points, essentially. So
yeah, but that's the whole spin thing. You can turn anything ugly if you try hard enough. And it's just amazing that people get away with it. That's the incredible thing to me.
Yeah, no, that's very true. Yeah, I mean, and it occurs on, sadly, both sides have done it. I say both sides as though they're, like, let's be honest, they're de facto only two sides of the political aisle in this country, because all our third parties don't have quite as much power, but it's very sad. And yet, of course, like with a novel like The Red, your focus is on the people who essentially are not quite victims per se, but are certainly, they're just kind of, they have to do a job within this system that is not exactly going to work in their benefit. I mean, the very beginning of your novel has the guys, the main character basically tells us, yeah, we're out in kind of the middle of nowhere where you don't have all the supplies we're supposed to have, but we're supposed to do a job, and so we have to go do it.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck. Have fun.
And don't get killed.
Yeah, basically. Which is very fortunate, because your main character has like second sight or something. You can kind of tell when there's something fishy going on, which is nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Always handy in those circumstances.
Yeah, I assume so. Paul, you wanted to jump in, I think, yeah.
Yeah. So jumping topics slightly into you were traditionally published, you took off writing for a while, and then now have come back in much more of an indie self-publishing sort of manner, with especially through Book Through Cafe and your own site. I was just wondering how that experience was and what you've learned from going your own way, so to speak.
I love going my own way. Publishing was a really, really emotionally difficult experience for me. Having no say over how the books were going to be published, not hearing anything for months on end, pouring everything I had into a given book and just to see it completely vanish and go out of print in very short order. It was traumatizing. You know, I had some good luck at Bantam. I had great covers, but the books came out in mass market. What I did write back then was, the moment they went out of print, I asked for my rights back. So I had the rights back to the first four books, I think, before 2000.
That was pretty smart of you, yeah.
Yeah, because you probably can't do that now.
No.
Like, what, you want your rights back? No, I don't think so.
And then I think I got the rights back on Limited Vision, which was my last traditionally published book, about 6 months before the whole indie publishing thing really became the thing. So that was a struggle of about 9 months to get those rights back, but I got them back just in time.
Sounds like a very grueling process.
Well, it wasn't with Bantam. It was a little tougher with Tor. But in the end, it worked out. And I don't know. I mean, I enjoy indie publishing. Even in the 90s, I had this interest in publishing. But it is hard. I'm not going to say otherwise. It's you get to handle everything yourself, and basically I'm judging whether my books are ready to go out in the world or not. That whole thing of where if an editor picks up your book and says, "Oh, I love this. This is great. We're going to publish it." That does wonders for your confidence level. When you have to do all that yourself, or try to get people to read your book and give you feedback on it, it's a little tougher in that sense. I don't think I have the innate confidence to really pull it off well, but sometimes you just have to press onward and get it done.
That's going to be the most worrying part, you know, and as somebody who has been traditionally published and then who has shifted now to publishing some of your work, a lot of your short stories are still appearing in the magazine markets, but it's got to be very, very terrifying, but in a kind of informed way, to kind of go from, you know, having somebody that, like you were saying, that is telling you this is good stuff, we need to edit A, B, and C, but otherwise it's good. And then going into a world where you have to make that determination, because there's so many people who don't, don't even bother. Or if they do, it's very clear their judgment is impaired because they're releasing something that is not. It's not. It should never have been released. Mm-hmm. But, you know, do you just have to, as a writer, just get to a point where you just go, okay, I can't think objectively about it anymore. This is as close as I'm going to get to feeling it's ready, and just go.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I could have easily taken this book and worked on it for another year, and I doubt that it would have been improved. I mean, I think it works really well the way that it is. Mm. But to not have that, they call it validation, I guess, to have that external validation of somebody who you assume or hope knows what makes a good book, says, yes, it's ready to go. I do miss that.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, on the other hand, it's kind of a fallacy to think that that's really what goes on a lot in traditional publishing, because editors are very busy people and they don't necessarily have the time to sit there and make sure this is the absolute best book it can be. So
that is true. Yeah.
Most of the drawbacks in indie publishing, frankly, they're reflected in traditional publishing as well. The big thing that I'm missing is that the book will not be generally distributed in bookstores. But then again, a lot of traditional books don't seem to be showing up in bookstores necessarily. So,
well, in these days, with the way the internet market works, half the bookstores are going away now, mm-hmm. unfortunately. It's sad, but also it's probably, unfortunately, some of those bookstores, it's their own fault. I'm not saying all of them. Some of them just really shitty business practices. Borders! and Barnes & Noble. Yeah. Barnes & Noble's pissing me off because I own a Nook and I'm mad. How do you blow an opportunity like that? I don't get it. Angry Sean.
I can understand it.
Yeah, but it's frustrating because, you buy, like, I guess it's not a big deal for a Nook because I can stick just about anything on there as long as I can get it in EPUB. But, you get to that point where you get locked into a device and it's really kind of depressing when you lose or where it seems like you might lose because we're not sure what Barnes & Noble is doing about the Nook. Presumably the Kindle is just destroying the market, and I understand why. When you go onto Amazon and you browse, with the exception of the flaw that there are, unfortunately, 10 trillion books published by self-published people that unfortunately only like 1% of those are worth even considering because a lot of them are just, it's just clear they just cheap shot, just put a cheap cover on it and threw it out there. But there is something that Amazon does that is, they're just really damn good at working with their customers. And it's because they look at what their customers do, what their customers want in terms of a browsing experience, in terms of finding material, and they just give it. Barnes & Noble doesn't do that. I mean, I just don't get it. I don't understand how you could have one of the worst online browsing systems through their BNN.com. BNN.com is terrible for finding anything on there. I don't get how they could be that bad. They've been booksellers for decades, haven't they? I don't know. Whatever. But anyway, so back to... Let's stop, because I'll go into a whole rant on that. But actually, so that's kind of related to this, and I think Paul kind of brought it up, but Bookview Cafe is this very interesting project that's been... I mean, a lot of folks such as yourself and like Ursula K. Le Guin, there's Vonda McIntyre, and other people, I think Paul and I were kind of naming off names we recognized earlier. And it's very interesting that you've worked with them as well for your work. And this book is, I think it's eventually coming out through Bookview Cafe, is it not?
Yeah, it'll be distributed there. I'm a little different from most of the writers there because I started doing this all on my own for probably over a year before I joined Bookview Cafe. And being, apparently I'm a control freak, this is something I learned once I got into indie publishing. So I still produce my books under my own imprint, Mythic Island Press, LLC.
Okay.
But they are part of Bookview Cafe, so they're basically distributed through there. And besides the bookstore itself, which, by the way, you can buy your EPUB versions at Book View Cafe. You can also buy Mobi versions. And they will go on to your Kindle or your Nook. Okay, advertisement over. Some of the members, like Chris Dolly, has been very active in getting the books into library ebook programs. He's very cutting edge on doing this. And he's also working on some getting hooked up with agents who sell translation rights to books. So that's something new. And he's just very forward looking and is finding all sorts of ways to expand what Bookview Cafe does for its author members.
That's actually really interesting, because that's something I've always wondered, you know, for indie and self-published authors, you know, there are some that are very, very popular. You know, what do they do with the, like, you know, the translation rights? Do they even get offers for them? Because, like, you know, you look at someone like John Scalzi, who's a very popular science fiction author who's traditionally published. He's got some of his books are in like 20 languages.
Mm-hmm.
But I've not heard of many self-published authors whose books are in 20 languages. Maybe they exist. I don't know. That's, and yet you're suggesting that Bookview Cafe is actually trying to get into that, figure out ways to make that work, which is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So this book, for all you know, could be in German in a year.
That would be nice.
They actually have a really big science fiction market, so who knows?
Do they? Yeah, I have had one book translated into German. Yeah.
They like their epic fantasy a lot there, too, I understand.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. It is very interesting, the translation market, I think. That's a very... I don't want to say quite lucrative. Depends where, I guess, you get translated. But it's certainly... you know, there's a sense that there's a pining for more genre fiction in various international markets. And so you do see a lot of genre being translated, which I think is really great. So we get that cross-pollination. I just wish it went the other direction more often, too. we got German stuff translated to English more often.
Yeah, there's a couple French, a little Chinese. It's drips and drabs at best.
Yeah. It's unfortunate, but I suspect that's going to change over time. But yeah. So I'm sorry. We're kind of like wandering into all these interesting topics that are related, actually, like your publication history, the various military aspects of this particular book. One last little thing I did want to bring up is it's something that I find very interesting in any work, that your characters are very much a mixture of cultures and peoples in terms of this particular unit. I mean, there's even this really beautiful description in which you basically just very simply tell us that these are people that are of various skin tones and that this is a very mixed unit. And I was very curious, not so much like why you would want to write characters that are people of color, because I think that's a stupid question that sometimes gets asked, because I don't think that's fair. More just a question of, you know, what was the experience of writing characters who are such various races and presumably creeds as well, since you're obviously, we talked before, you're writing peoples in Africa, so you're dealing with... local cultures that are obviously not our own cultures. I was just curious about that kind of experience.
Well, I mean, I live in Hawaii, and we're probably the most mixed race place. Well, certainly in the U.S., I would think, but it's just a fact of life. And all of my books, going back to the beginning, have used people of different ethnic backgrounds and mixed races. And I mean, you know, I'm a white woman married to a Japanese American. My kids are mixed race. It's the way the world is. So that's really why I do it in the book. And it's the quirk of the main character that he's always looking at these things. He's always looking at what the racial background of people is, or he'll guess at it. And it's like a hobby. It's not like it's important to him. It doesn't mean, oh, this is a good person or interesting person. It's just the way he is, just because he's curious about it. And that's actually very common here where I live. a lot of times you'll say, oh, I met somebody, and it'll eventually come up. You'll say, what is racial background is? And it's just another data of who that person is and what they're about. And it just, the mixes out here are absolutely amazing. When I was a kid in school, there was a term chop suey. Just say, oh, well, he's Chinese and he's Hawaiian and I'm chop suey. And it doesn't seem, you know, and I'm not saying that there's no racial issues here or whatever, but it doesn't seem to be that big a deal. You know, it's not. Well, I guess, Sean, that I've been seeing your posts on G+ lately where you're talking about people who are saying, oh, they're trying to breed the white race out of existence.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I just realized that kind of came up when you were talking about your own particular family. And I was going to make a snarky comment, but then I thought that might be rude, so I didn't do it. But you're right. Like, there are these people.
Like, who are you talking to?
Look, YouTube is a hellhole. And every once in a while, I have a lapse of judgment, and I just have to comment on something. And I watched this video, I think the title is like, was it white racist is code word for anti-white or something like that. It's the dumbest video. And the video essentially claims that there's genocide being committed against the white race. And so I thought, okay, I'll treat these people as though they're at least partially rational humans. My mistake. Oops.
Big mistake.
And so I asked them, okay, where is the evidence of genocide? And I mean genocide in the proper sense of the term, which is a deliberate intent to destroy a people, whether it's – I mean, you could commit genocide through breeding programs. It's been tried, right? There it is. You can do that. They do try to do it in Australia against the Aboriginal people. And so if that's true, I'm actually really curious if there are people actually saying, let's breed the white race out of existence. Not that white is, I think calling what the white race like a race is just stupid, because there's no like single like white group, just as there's no single like black group and yada yada blah blah, right? But I want to know, like, where are they getting this information from? And what I found was they have no information whatsoever. There's no evidence whatsoever of any systematic attempt to exterminate the white race through interbreeding. And so I keep coming up to them and going, why do you keep saying this? And it just got to a point where I just had to make snarky comments on Google+ about it, because it's the most mind-numbingly stupid. These are people who claim, you know, they often claim themselves to be scientifically minded people, but then they don't even understand what evidence is. Like, they think that rape rates in Europe are evidence that black people are trying to rape white people out of existence. I shit you not. That is what people actually in these groups think is happening. They have no evidence that this is all the black people in Europe like sat down and said, we're going to rape them out of existence. They just say it as though it's somehow truth. And I just keep – and so it's my mistake. Every once in a while I have a lapse in judgment, and I get involved with really stupid people on YouTube. And yeah.
But that's the drawback of the internet, right? I mean, so much of this stuff we would never have heard of back in, say, the 80s. But now it can all be front and center, and everybody can go, oh my God, that's so awful, and retweet it all around the world.
Unfortunately. I mean, well, fortunate and unfortunate, because I guess it's kind of nice that we're having a discussion about these groups that otherwise would be isolated. But on the other hand, of course, we have to hear the things that come out of their mouths.
Yeah. they get a lot more publicity this way.
But I mean, on that front, I've never actually been to Hawaii. So the only things I know about Hawaii are from reading historical information and yada yada.
And Hawaii 5-0.
Well, that don't know.
I was thinking of the Brady Bunch episode.
Or that.
That was my first experience with Hawaii. The second one was this weird projector set that my brother and I had gotten, which had like, it was like travel projector slides. And then we had three sets. I forgot what one of them was. One was Russia and the other one was Hawaii. It was like a book and you put the projector slides on and you learn all about Hawaii and what to do when you got there to travel. It was the weirdest thing I ever owned.
In quotey things, of course, when you mean learn all about Hawaii, in quotes.
Well, I learned a little bit about Hawaii and Russian, not a lot, but enough. I learned Russia's have rubles and all this, and what Red Square was and all this stuff, and
fair enough.
And all this fun stuff. It was weird.
Well, I guess the question I was kind of wondering, since I've not been to Hawaii, and you've obviously lived there for a considerable amount of time, mm-hmm. do you get the impression that Hawaii, relatively speaking, in comparison to much of continental United States, has at least from your experience, has had a more what's the right way of putting this? A more friendly relationship between various groups. This is such a poor way of putting it, but I hope that makes sense what I'm asking.
Well, if intermarriage is any indication, I would have to say absolutely.
I think that's a good indication if various racial groups are marrying more freely than they would, say, in Mississippi. That seems to be a good indicator.
Yeah, back in, I think it was at least the 90s. It might have been earlier. The banking commercials for local banks, their standard couple would be an Asian woman and a Caucasian man.
Huh.
So that, to me, that just tells you how mainstream it is. And in fact, in politics here, you will often see couples who are Asian Caucasian, no matter which one of them is running for office. We seem to feel the need that I shouldn't say feel the need. I'm not saying people get married to make good political couples, but it's almost universal. So
that's so interesting. Yeah. Cause I mean, I'm currently in the South and you don't see that. I mean, there are certainly lots of interracial couples here, but there's less of it. It's still unfortunately taboo among certain groups. And you'll even hear, like, there was the case of the guy in Alabama or some, I don't remember which state it was, in which this judge actually refused to grant a marriage license to an interracial couple because he said that their children would suffer as a result of being half black, which...
Now, in contrast to that, I got married in 83, and I had a great aunt at the time who was well into her 90s, and her family was from Missouri, and she had absolutely no problem whatsoever with the fact that I had an interracial marriage. And this just, I mean, I was very impressed with this at the time.
It happens.
I just expected questions, you know. So
there is certainly that sense, like, and I'm probably being somewhat unfair to the South. I mean, I don't want to make it seem like the South is full of, like, frothing at the mouth racists who just run around screaming about mixed race couples and things. But it does sometimes surprise, you know, when you do learn about people who you would expect, and unfortunately you expect a certain perspective from them, and then they have the complete opposite. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've had that experience with just, like, certain political views. I've met people here who, my first impression of them, like, you are a right-wing Christian conservative, and I know we're going to disagree about a lot of stuff, but we can be friendly. And then you find out, like, wait, no, they're almost exactly the same as me.
Yeah.
Like, how did this happen? My worldview's shattered.
Yes.
Not that there's something necessarily wrong with being a conservative, just that there's expectations of certain perspectives that you just don't share. But I guess that does happen probably more frequently than I'm used to. I'm also from California, so when I moved here, there is some truth to that sort of comedic saying that the racism is different. Mm-hmm. It is somewhat more pronounced, so it's very different. But anyway, we're kind of like wandering into a lot of interesting topics, but it's interesting stuff, I think, talking from a cultural perspective. So
welcome to the Skippy and Fanti show,
where we talk about the hard, tough stuff. Yeah.
Where we wander into weird digressions on anything.
Yeah. But Paul was trying to give me a note that go to the five questions. I don't actually have the five questions this time.
You don't?
No.
You didn't ask me to come up with the five questions.
I don't always do them.
All right. So why don't you ask Linda one other quick question while I come up with the five questions?
Oh, well, I mean, I was going to ask, what can we expect from you in the next year? Presumably another novel.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, do you know if there are more short stories coming or other work that you've got coming out that you'd like to let people know about?
There's two more short stories on the way. There will be one in analog, I think in the May. No. Anyway, a couple of months down the road. It's on my website. That'll be another Zeke Choi story. That was Nahiku West, which was my first short story that published in over 10 years. Actually, the first short story I wrote since Goddesses came out.
Hmm.
And this is another Zeke Choi story, so that'll be out in analog. And I will actually have a story in Nightmare Magazine.
Ooh.
Which kind of surprised me, but John Joseph Adams wanted to put it in Nightmare. I had submitted it to Lightspeed. So that's cool.
Well, at least he returned your calls. Just teasing. Okay, so two short stories and presumably, possibly by next year, maybe another novel, or maybe yes. Not next year. Maybe it depends on your writing schedule, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I've started on the next novel. I haven't gotten very far. But that was starting in April. That'll be my main project. But I want to do some more short stories, too.
Do you find, I'm trying to put this in a completely coherent English way. Because you clearly have written a lot in both formats of the short form and the novel form. And I know sometimes we have authors who do have that experience of writing in both forms fairly regularly. What do you find is the major downside and the major upside of writing in each form?
Well, I have to say first that I haven't written that much in short stories in what I think of as the first part of my career, 2000 before. I had 10 published short stories. That was the entire mass of it, and one of those was the novella. But since I started writing short stories again about a year and a half ago, I think I've done about 8, so I've almost caught up on myself. And I didn't like to write them before. They were hard. You had to come up with whole worlds, and just trying to cram a plot into that small space was really difficult for me back then. And now that I'm into it again, I really, really enjoy writing them. Just to be able to finish something in a reasonable amount of time is an incredible reward. To take less than a year to do it.
That's true. Yeah, I mean that's primarily what I'm writing right now is short stories. I do find that they're easier to get finished.
Yes.
Than novels.
And what I found, I mean, the Red First Light is evidence of it. Is they're great for developing ideas and characters.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I've actually, that's something too. One of the novels I'm trying to work on was inspired by a bunch of short stories that were set in another world, which I'd never thought that those would become the basis for, or at least would it go lead into a novel length work, but then there it was. So, and maybe one day I'll be a published author person. We'll see.
The very best of luck to you on that.
Thank you. Well, it's certainly by the time I get a novel finished and in any shape for publication, I'm sure like the publishing will just implode and it'll just become like Battle Royale and we'll just have to fight for publishing contracts to the death.
Wait, aren't we doing that now?
Just about. That's true.
Round two, fight.
But, you know, who knows? Who knows what publishing is going to be like in 5 years or, you know, even 2 years? I mean, good Lord. I mean, they'll probably just beam stories into your head. You won't have to read them. They'll just be done in 3 seconds.
Oh, that would be great. I could read so much more then. I'm handicapped by being a slow reader.
Yeah, I'm a pretty slow reader too. It would be kind of cool if you could read really fast. I don't know about comprehension though.
Yeah, that's what I always wonder about.
All right, Paul, do you got those five questions?
I do.
All right, have at it.
Okay. Number, you ready, Linda?
Yep.
Okay. I went irreverent. So, anyway, number one, Spam or Poi?
Both.
As living in Minnesota, we appreciate that Hawaii supports our spam industry down in Austin.
Hey, spam is awesome.
So I don't have anything bad to say about spam. I've only tried Poi once. I don't think it was prepared right, but anyway, number two.
It took me a long time to like Poi.
I don't know what Poi. I'm sorry. This is gonna be a stupid question. What is Poi?
Poi is it was basically the main carbohydrate dish of Hawaiians in particular, and one of the main of most Polynesians. It's the pounded root of the taro plant, otherwise known as kalo.
Oh, interesting. Okay, I'm going to have to try it someday.
In fact, it was a baby food. I used that as a baby food for my kids, along with other things, of course. But it's a great food because most people do not have allergies to it, so people who are allergic to other things and can't eat them can eat poi.
Cool.
In many cases.
All right, question number two, Paul.
Okay, beachcombing or volcano hiking?
Volcano hiking.
You're crazy.
I've seen her picture standing next to lava. I kind of figured that one. She was gonna go with that one.
Not in a million years. Never. I will fly over a volcano.
Well, you know, they're not always live volcanoes.
Yeah, that's what they thought in 2012.
I live on a volcano.
I'm sorry. I'm neurotic. There are two things that, like, there are a couple things I just don't do. I don't swim in the ocean. Because I've seen people get eaten by sharks, and no thank you.
You've seen it?
On the internet. That's close enough. Also, I've almost drowned in the ocean, so no thanks. I'm okay with not drowning and not getting eaten. And then, you know, just volcanoes. I just know, like, I'll go on a volcano, and that'll be the day it decides to erupt. And
but you're okay with those hurricanes down there in Florida, right?
I'm in northern Florida, so we don't get them here.
Yes, you get folk hurricanes, just not so often in Gainesville.
They're very rare, and usually if they come this far inland, we get a little wind, but it's not. It, like, houses aren't going to be ripped from their moorings or anything. So I won't ever live anywhere where my house could get destroyed once a year. No, thank you. I'm being somewhat irrational. I'm sorry.
Moving on.
Yeah, question three, Paul.
Orbital habitat or fantasy kingdom?
Oh, I'm tempted to ask, what kind of fantasy kingdom?
Well, you've done both, so.
I'm going to have to go with both on that one, too.
Okay. Ferry or plane?
What was that?
Ferry or plane?
Wait, what kind of ferry are we talking about? You just started about fantasy kingdom.
like a ferry between islands.
Oh, got it. Okay.
Plane.
And finally, since you live on Maui, Oahu or Kauai?
Oh, it depends what you want to do.
What do you want to do?
Probably Oahu, because most of what Kauai has, we have too.
Aha, perfect.
There we go.
Awesome.
Cool.
So, last, just the quick question, which is, where can people find you? So, like, your website, and I know you mentioned that you don't get to make any convention appearances, but if you're making any this year, that would, you know, if you could let us know, that'd be great.
No, I've got nothing scheduled. But everything about me is over there at mythicisland.com. Basically, I think you can Google my name. I haven't done it in a while, but it'll point you right to my website.
Perfect. And if you go there, you can find all of Linda's books and all of the short stories where they're published, all that good stuff. There's a blog and all sorts of good stuff. So you should go there and you should check it out. So,
yes, please. Thank you very much.
She's also Linda Nagata on Twitter.
Yes.
And on Facebook.
And on Google Plus.
I'm just everywhere.
Pretty much. Yeah. You're just like a like an invasive species on the internet. No, I'm just...
That's right.
Oh, wherever you are,
show up.
I'm teasing. I don't mean that seriously. Anywho, so we kind of ran, obviously, we always do this. We run for a while, but we had lots of interesting things to talk about. But that pretty much does it for the show. So thank you very much, Linda, for coming on.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, and hopefully you'll let us know when you got more work coming out so we can let people know and get you back on here at some point.
Great. Thanks cool. so much.
Sure.
Thanks,
and
Linda.
We'll see everybody next week.
Good night.
Night.
Good night.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.